From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM, floating format tonight. By the way, might as well tell you, a little member of our family has joined us. My daughter gave birth, finally, to little Gavin Michael. 7 pounds, 6 ounces. He's 21 inches tall. A little guy. Looks like a little tiny spider monkey. Black hair all over the place. And they're both doing fine. They thought for a moment they were going to have to do a C-section, but they did not have to. So all is well there. I'll put some pictures up on the Digicam in a day or two when we get them. Well, NASA has released details of its strategy for sending a human crew to Mars within the next few decades. The space agency envisions dispatching a minimal crew on a 30-month round trip to the Red Planet aboard an 880,000-pound spacecraft. The Mars ship would be assembled in low Earth orbit using 3 to 4 Ares V rockets, the new heavy lift launch vehicle that NASA has been developing. Now, they will plan a launch February 2031. The mission's journey from Earth to Mars would take 6 to 7 months in a spacecraft powered by an advanced cryogenic fuel propulsion system. Estimates of the cost mounting for a manned Mars mission, $20 billion to $450 billion. But when they do this, I'll be 81 years old. There's still a slight possibility that asteroid Apophis may hit us in 2036. Using limited observations and lots of high-end computer modeling, astronomers have gotten a better handle on the limitations of asteroid tracking forecasting here. And they say Apophis' chance of hitting our planet in its first pass, that's in 2029, is now slim to none. But now astronomers are saying they're going to have to wait 4 to 6 years before they can predict what it might do during the second pass in 2036. A team of scientists arrived at this conclusion after accounting for small influences like the solar wind, gravitational drag of smaller asteroids, and human error. The rock is between 690 and 1,080 feet wide, much smaller than the 6-mile-wide rock that smashed into the Yucatan, but they say this is large enough to take out a city or create a massive tsunami if it hits in the ocean. Once styled as Earth's twin, Venus was transformed from a heaven for water to a fiery hell by an unstoppable greenhouse effect, according to an investigation by the first space probe to visit our closest neighbor in more than a decade. The European Space Agency's Venus Express has been orbiting since April of 2006. Its preliminary data is showing that Venus used to be very much like Earth, but greenhouse gases wiped things up. Now, to the best of my knowledge, I do not believe they had factories or cars on Venus to contribute to the greenhouse gases. I don't think. Saudi Arabia has arrested 208 suspected terrorists in 6 cells and stopped several planned attacks in the kingdom's largest terror sweep to date. Among the plots, an attack, a very imminent attack on their oil installations in the country's east, which is home to most of their petroleum reserves. Police in Slovakia and Hungary have arrested 3 people, seizing 2.2 pounds of an unspecified but very dangerous radioactive material. The suspects are trying to sell the stuff for $1 million. In Niagara Falls, a judge who jailed 46 people who were in his courtroom when a cell phone call interrupted his proceedings has been removed by the bench by a state commission. They say that he just went mad. In Korea, an exploding mobile phone battery apparently killed a South Korean man in the first such known case in that country. The man was found dead at his workplace with a melted battery in his shirt pocket. A 400-year-old book covered in a sheet of wrinkled human skin is going under the auction block. It's thought the skin was cut from the corpse of one of Guy Fawkes' fellow conspirators in the gunpowder plot of 1605. That was an attempt to blow up the British Parliament in a bid to kill King James I. I want to read something that the very late President Theodore Roosevelt said, talking about immigrants and immigration. It's very important to tonight's program and our very special guest who's coming up in just a few moments. This is what he said. In the first place, we should insist that if the immigrant who comes here in good faith becomes an American and assimilates himself to us, he shall be treated on an exact equality with everyone else. For it is an outrage to discriminate against any such man because of creed or birthplace or origin. But this is predicated upon the man's becoming in very fact an American, and nothing but an American. There can be no divided allegiance here. Any man who says he's an American but something else also isn't an American at all. We have room for but one flag, the American flag. And this excludes the red flag, which symbolizes all wars against liberty and civilization, just as much as it excludes any foreign flag of a nation to which we are hostile. We have room for but what one language here, and that is the English language. And we have room for but one sole loyalty, and that is a loyalty to the American people. In a moment, Pat Buchanan joins us. His latest work, Day of Reckoning, he's next on Coast to Coast AM. Patrick Buchanan was a senior advisor to three American presidents, ran twice for the Republican nomination for the presidency in 1992 and 96. He was the Reform Party's presidential candidate in 2000, author of several books, including The Death of the West and Where the Right Went Wrong, as well as Right from the Beginning and A Republic, Not an Empire, and also Day of Reckoning, which we're talking about tonight. Mr. Buchanan is a syndicated columnist, a political analyst, and he has been on this program before, and he is on for the complete show tonight on Coast to Coast. Pat, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you very much, George. I'm delighted to talk with you again.
Boy, since the last time you were with us, which was August of 2006, a little more than a year ago, this country has turned itself upside down, Pat. What the heck is going on?
I think one of the things that turned us upside down was a public uprising against the wholesale invasion of the United States from Mexico and from the Third World across our southern borders, and a unawareness on the part of the national elites, political, economic, and otherwise, who were unaware of what was going on in this country. But this populist uprising did defeat and rout an amnesty bill for 12 to 20 million illegal aliens that was supported by the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Chamber of Commerce, La Raza. And that tremendous populist uprising, I think, has altered presidential politics to the point where all the Republican candidates are now for securing the border and building a fence on the border and no amnesty and cracking down on businesses and no sanctuary city. That's one of the things, certainly, that's a dramatic change from the time in 2006 when we were talking about state of emergency.
You know, I read this quote from Teddy Roosevelt, who, you know, really hit it right on the head. And he said, you know what, we love immigrants, we want them in this country, but here are the rules. And it seems like there aren't any more rules anymore, Pat.
There aren't any rules. And exactly what Teddy Roosevelt was talking about is what is coming to pass. In a remarkable phrase, he said, the one thing that can really destroy this country is for it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities. In other words, folks who come to America but don't come to become Americans, who are hyphenated Americans, who have one foot in another land and one foot in the United States, who retain loyalties to other countries and don't seek to, if you will, put off the skin of the foreign lands, as John Quincy Adams says, to become true Americans. And I think this is what many Americans fear, and this is what is happening. We have folks coming from all over the world now, millions of them illegally, into the United States, who come here to work. Many of them are hardworking folks. But the truth is, many come not to become Americans and are not assimilating. And there is no demand from our political elites, like Woodrow Wilson, like Theodore Roosevelt, that they do assimilate into the United States. And to me, at the same time, we're in the middle of a culture war. We were at war with one another over matters of morality and right and wrong and God and how life ought to be lived. That culture war going on at the same time, increasingly we're in an ethnic and even racial conflict in this country. This, to me, is the great existential threat to the survival of the nation. And that's what I talk about in Day of Reckoning. A number of crises are all coming at one time, and they're all arriving at one time in this country, and I think they threaten the existence of America as one nation and one people.
Pat, if someone had told you 15 or 20 years ago that we're going to be pushing for a North American alliance, a joint venture between Mexico, the United States, and Canada, and maybe all as one, that the currency might be changed from the dollar to the Amero in order to fight back on Europe, the Euro, what would you have said then, 15, 20 years ago, if you had heard that?
Well, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, I was working in the White House of Ronald Reagan, and I would have said, you know, that's an impossibility. The people dreaming of world government have failed. They originally wanted to put it together under the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund and the International Court at The Hague. And I would have said, we've defeated that. That's not going to happen. But there is a new powerful forces, I think, that are at work in this country and outside this country to put an end to the United States as a independent, sovereign, unique, different nation. And these forces, what makes them so powerful is that these forces include many of the most 100 most powerful economic entities on Earth, which are global corporations, which seek the erasure of all borders so that goods and people can move back and forth, so that all laws can be harmonized. And these forces are looking ultimately toward a world in which there is a single, what they call global governance. In other words, a transnational unit like the European Union over the entire world. You now have it over Europe, the EU, and they're seeking to have that over the United States of America, Canada, and Mexico. And the idea is that of a North American Union, where we merge our country with Mexico. And quite frankly, George, they are very close to success. The North American Union is embryonic more than it is anything else as an institution, but NAFTA is the basis of it. And the idea is maturing that we should, instead of putting a secure fence along the American border with Mexico, we should erase that border and let people and goods move back and forth across freely. The governor, the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, he is much more out of the closet on this issue, much more outspoken on it. He went to speak in Europe in 2002, and he says, we want to model the North American Union on the European Union, where all borders are basically being erased and goods and people and factories and plants and things move back and forth from one country to another. So I think this project, as it were, is really maturing, and it is the way toward, I think, the end of sovereignty and independence of the United States.
I think you're absolutely right, Pat, and it's moving faster than I ever imagined. Who concocted this? I'm going to call it a brilliant plan, because to date, the way it's moving is brilliant. I don't agree with it, but it is brilliant. Who concocted this thing?
Well, you know, the idea of a world government, initially of a world government, has been around a long time. In my book, Day of Reckoning, Immanuel Kant, he talks about perpetual peace. And the way to achieve that is a federation of all the nations of the world. And the poem by Locksley Hall, I believe it's Tennyson's poem, talks about that, the federation of man and the parliament of the world. It's been sort of a vision. They sought to achieve it with the League of Nations, and that, of course, failed. Woodrow Wilson was a great believer in that idea, that the United States of America should be the model for the world government, that just as the states of the Union gave up their sovereignty and independence to a national union, the federal government, and that government grew in power to the point when the states tried to break away, they were crushed in 1861. That this should be the model for the world, and the world government would bring about an egalitarian, democratic, and universally diverse single parliament of man and federation of the world. And so it's got its roots in these ideas, and it's a recurring idea, George, and it is very much a utopian idea, but it has moved men, and they're not bad men, all of them. It has moved men to try to say, this is the way for peace on earth.
Yes.
It is a substitute religion. It is an ideology. But the fact that it keeps recurring and recurring, and it comes in various forms. You see it, the idea behind Marxism, for example, of one government for the entire world. It, what's happened is since World War II, it matured in the United Nations idea. When I was young, they were saying the United Nations is the last best hope of mankind. But that, of course, failed because the United States Nations failed so dismally. But the new idea that is succeeding, and succeeding, if you will, quietly, moving on little cat's feet, is this idea of an economic union. In other words, we have free trade among all nations. And if we can achieve free trade among and between all nations, of course, we're going to have to eliminate borders, and we're going to have to harmonize all laws. The most advanced idea, or the maturation or the maturity of the idea, is the European Union, which is a model for all of these unions. And you hear talk of an Asian Union modeled on the European Economic Union, which is now rising up to the European Union and becoming a transnational government. So this idea has been maturing, but I would think basically the economic elites and the political elites of the country, many of whom no longer have loyalty or allegiance to nations, and, you know, someone said they spend more time in Paris than they do in the heart of their own country, or Tokyo or Hong Kong or Beijing or Moscow. So I think these are the forces, and many of them are at work, quite frankly, unknowingly of the ends toward which we are headed.
Well, and you know, Pat, on the face of it, it sounds like a Star Trekian plan where the federation of this country in this world all comes together for the good of all. You know, and on the face of it, you think, now, isn't this great? We're going to create harmony around this planet. But what we've lost is the sovereignty of every country here. We can probably still save the world's ills by still being separate countries, couldn't we?
Well, certainly. I mean, to me, the last great hope of mankind has always been the United States of America. You've touched on it exactly. The price we are being asked to pay for a world of harmony, which we're promised, in a world of the free exchange of goods where everyone works together and there's no more war, and it's all peaceful commerce, the price we're being asked to pay is the sovereignty and independence and unique character of the United States of America. The price we're being asked to pay is that for which the revolution was fought and why the Constitution was signed, was to create a new, independent, different people upon this planet. And so that's what we're being asked to pay, is our unique identity. And as Sophocles said, there is no greater sadness on the earth than losing one's country. And this is a very gradual process. It's the process of, and the European Union was begun with the European Coal and Steel Community back, I believe, in 1953, the Common Market in 1957. So that's a half a century ago, and it's during my lifetime. And we are at the beginnings of that process in America with Mexico and Canada. But the difference here is now that first, the European peoples are alerted to it. And the European Constitution, the constitution of a new transnational government mm-hmm. that sits above Europe, was rejected by the French and the Dutch in elections. And the people of Europe are saying, no, no more surrender of sovereignty, no more surrender of independence. We'll go for the free trade agreements we got, but we want to keep our unique, different, independent countries. And the American people are alerted to it. And frankly, one of the driving forces in it has been the mass migrations across from Mexico into the United States. And Americans clearly are outraged and angered by that. And they're increasingly aware of what you and I are talking about, that people in Washington, D.C. are resisting building a security fence because they ultimately have in mind erasing the border.
Well, Pat, I've got to tell you, you've done a great job in this book, of course, with all of yours, Day of Reckoning, because this one hits home. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back. I want to chat with you about the borders and what's going on there, why the influx. I think all of us agree controlled immigration has always been good for this country, but we're talking about illegal immigration. So we'll be back in a moment. Our special guest tonight is Pat Buchanan, author of the brand new book called Day of Reckoning. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got the floating format tonight. We've got our special guest, Patrick Buchanan, Day of Reckoning. In Pat's last hour tonight, he'll be with us for the rest of this hour, next hour, and then his last hour, about 2.5 or so hours. In his last hour, we'll take phone calls. In the final hour of the program, I was able to land Richard C. Hoagland tonight to comment and take your questions about this new Mars initiative to go to Mars by 2031. Let me tell you, I really had to bend Richard's arm to get him on the show tonight. Many aspects we're going to talk with Pat Buchanan about in Day of Reckoning, about the war in Iraq, the plunging dollar, and everything else that's happening to us right now. Pat, how do we tear ourselves away from the humanitarian part of this and the illegal immigration part of this? You know, I live in Los Angeles and St. Louis, and I see a lot of people from Mexico who are here. Probably some are illegal, maybe most of them. They can't speak English, but they are working like crazy. I mean, they're doing roofing jobs, landscaping, brickwork. I mean, they're dedicated, hardworking individuals who just want a better life. So on one hand, I feel for these people. I mean, my gosh, they're not getting this break in Mexico. On the other hand, if they're illegals, we can't tolerate that. It's a tough decision, isn't it?
Well, it's very, very tough because, as you mentioned, when you meet individuals one by one, whether they're mowing lawns or washing cars, they are first friendly, and secondly, they are incredibly hardworking. Down in Mississippi and in New Orleans, as I understand it, when they couldn't get jobs done, these illegal aliens have gone down there working off the books and have done tremendous work. And many of them stay to themselves, and they're pleasant, and they work hard, and they work off the books. And there's no doubt about it. And they are coming here. Why? The vast majority, some, of course, now come, are engaged in slave traffic of women on the borders. They're engaged in smuggling people into the United States. They're engaged in narcotics. But the vast majority are clearly here to work very hard. And they send their remittances, as they're called, back to their own country. $23 billion in 2006 went back to Mexico. And so you say to them, look, these are good folks. They've got the same motivation coming here as our folks did. And so why don't we just amnesty them and let them become citizens and put them on a path to citizenship? The problem is this, George, is that the numbers are enormous. The number of Mexicans here is far greater than any immigrant group that has ever come to the United States of America. The illegals alone are equal to all the Jewish folks, all the English, and all the Irish who ever came. And if you do not enforce your border and you do not enforce the laws, I think most of Mexico, or at least half of Mexico, will wind up in the United States. I think the border will be erased as a consequence, and I think that will be the end of the United States as an independent, sovereign nation. Now, if this invasion, as you suggest, were being done militarily, the Mexican army coming into the United States, we would know how to respond. Mm-hmm. But what is happening is, as you suggest, these are good folks. They're coming across the border. They're going to Los Angeles. They're working hard. But they're bringing with them enormous problems as well. The young males who are the children of illegals and even the children of immigrants who are Hispanic and Mexican join gangs at something like 19 times the rate of American citizens. Secondly, people prefer to live among their own, and the number are so great in California that the Anglos, or European Americans, 2 million of them simply left California for the first time in the 1990s and are coming back over the mountains. So what's happening is a part of your country, basically the Southwest, you would say from Los Angeles south all the way around to Brownsville, Texas, and especially the southern part of those states, are receding to Mexico. And the question is, do you want to be tough? And if you are, and you use that rhetoric of Theodore Roosevelt's, which we need to do, I think you're in danger of having the loss of the Southwest de facto linguistically, ethnically, culturally to Mexico, and the ultimate end of the United States as a separate and unique nation.
And what would happen, Pat, if eventually, you know, this influx continues and maybe they get voting rights down the line? What happens one day when somebody decides we want this area to become part of Mexico or its own nation to itself, and we're going to take it to a vote? Is that possible?
That is possible, in my judgment. The Aslan plot is called. There are a number of the militant Mexicans talk about it. I think the much more likely thing is a situation of dual citizenship, where the Hispanics in the American Southwest who have allegiance and loyalty to Mexico demand and receive dual citizenship in the United States and Mexico. I believe that is already legal. In Mexico itself, they have realized it's belated. The initial realization, I think, was that, great, the United States is a safety valve for these angry, unemployed, and poor people who otherwise are going to be rebelling against us and overthrowing our government. Let them go to the United States, work hard, they can send their money back. It's a safety valve. That's the way we can push our problems north. Let them go on welfare or let them get jobs, and then they'll send back money and our problem is solved.
Mm-hmm.
But now they have come to realize the enormous political influence they can wield with, if you will, a huge fifth column in the United States with love of and loyalty to Mexico, its flag, the country, everything. And so they passed a constitutional amendment in Mexico to allow even Mexican Americans who have been here for generations to vote in Mexican elections and become dual citizens. And I think this is how it goes, much more likely than a formal departure. I don't know why they would try to secede from the United States and lose all the benefits of American citizenship. What they want is both to retain their Mexican nationality and their American citizenship, both. That is the ideal world, although the militants, as you suggest, are interested in the separate country of Aslan with its capital in L.A.
That's so true. That is so true. You know, and I'm on the bandwagon to get Ramos and Compeon released. I mean, here these guys shoot a drug dealer in the butt. They go to jail for it, and the same drug dealer gets arrested a few weeks ago bringing pounds and pounds of drugs back across the border.
Well, that is appalling.
It is. It's sickening.
How is the president of the United States?
He's not doing anything about
this. Surely got to be aware of the sentences for those two Border Patrol agents who shot the guy in the butt as he's running away. They think he had a gun in his hand, and they got all this dangerous situation on the border. They're in there for a dozen years in a penitentiary.
And the guy comes back with more drugs.
He comes back. I mean, it's like the American Civil Liberties Union has taken over George Bush's White House.
Why can't the president simply say, look, this is ridiculous, I'm going to pardon these people, I'm going to let them go, and that's the end of it, and give them back pay and let them go back to work if they would? Why won't he do that?
I don't know why he does it. My guess is the prosecutor of these police officers and the Justice Department might be putting him under some kind of pressure. But I don't understand. He stepped right up far more controversially and commuted the sentence of Scooter Libby, brought a firestorm down on his head. If he pardoned these two, he would be applauded and cheered. I don't understand it. I think it may be this, George. I think he has been so, if you will, raked over by the conservatives and populists in all parties for not securing the border. And he's so angry about how he's been rolled on this issue of illegal immigration and amnesty, he might say, I'm not giving those so-and-sos anything, and they're not going to pressure me to do this. I think it could be that he's got his back up against the people that defeated him on amnesty.
And he has, it's obvious, the rest of his administration for the next year is going to move toward the Middle East, and that's where he's going, and I think he's going to forget everything else.
I think he does want this Middle East deal, but I don't know how he's going to pull this off. because, well, he had a conference down in Annapolis and an agreement and White House handshakes and a photo op. I mean, the disagreements between the Palestinians as to what is the minimal they can accept and the Israelis and what is the most they can let go, I think are so hard and great. That's why this thing has eluded any agreement ever since the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin. I do think the president is transfixed by the Middle East, Iraq, and Afghanistan. If these go wrong, he has no legacy. He will be a failed president. That's where his focus is. I think his heart is still in the de facto erasure of borders, not because I'm convinced he's a member of some elite that wants to merge the two countries, but because he basically has this romantic notion of the United States and Mexico, two of them, open borders, the way it was when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And he doesn't realize we're in a new world where huge, I mean, vast, well, the numbers coming across the border are, this is not Ellis Island.
Jerry Corsi was telling me about the gang, and you mentioned the gangs, these gangs that keep coming up from other countries, from Guatemala, in these areas. I mean, it's just unbelievable. With all our troops spread all around this planet, and of course we don't have enough anyway, we could get them, the National Guard, and start lining up from Brownsville down through San Diego, and at least, you know, even before we get a fence built, at least start stationing these troops there.
Well, you know, I'm convinced, and George, I ran on this in 1991, and I was not as acutely aware of the issue, because in 1986, I was in Reagan's White House, and while we didn't like the idea of amnesty, we were unaware of the real magnitude of the problem until I went to California back in 1991, and that's all people in Southern California were talking about, and I said simply, well, in a short period, why don't you secure the border with the National Guard and build the fence along the overly traveled routes from Imperial Beach in about 14 miles, and that way the people who are trying to come across will come across in the desert, and you don't have hundreds of thousands coming across a desert, and the Border Patrol can deal with it. And so you raise the issue again and again. And, you know, it might have helped George Bush the first win the election if he said, I'm now aware of this and we're going to deal with it. But, George, you could build a two-line fence. The United States of America has done incredible achievements. A two-line security fence across the southern border of the United States, the federal government could get it done, especially the vital parts of it, the critical parts of it, in a matter of months, I'm convinced.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, Pat, I have said on this program time and time again that I don't believe in coincidences. I think things happen for a reason. And there's no doubt in my mind that the fact that we are not stopping the flow of illegals into this country, they want it to happen, and they're letting it happen, and they're not going to stop it.
Well, they are letting it happen. George, in the amnesty bill, everyone thought of it as amnesty for the illegal aliens. And as you say, all of us who see these folks and who run into them, and obviously not the ones who are drunk drivers or criminals, but the ones who are just working hard at these jobs and they can't speak English, but they smile and they're working away.
Nice people.
They're nice people. And I've got brothers who, one brother works in the kind of business construction. And he says these people work harder than anybody, Pat. They're good folks, and they don't give you any trouble. And they
most Americans, Pat, wouldn't take the job.
That's exactly right. It's certainly not at that pay. And so that's a real tug on Americans, that they like nice people and they like folks who work hard. But you are right to this extent. In that bill, George, there was, I found it, and Chuck Grassley had written a letter to the Washington Post angrily, which had criticized him. And they were talking about other things in the bill. He said this bill contains a lot of other things, including an amnesty from all civil and criminal penalties for any business that is hired.
See, that's the mistake.
And so that they put that in the bill, and who gets it in there? And where is all this pressure coming from when the whole country's in a firestorm? And as people say, why is George Bush committing suicide and dragging his party over the cliff? And why are Republicans up on the Hill going with this thing? I'll tell you, there's only one explanation. People are working the halls with a lot more power and influence over the congressmen than even a vast national uprising. And the only people with that power is the corporate community, which is seeking amnesty for itself.
Did you see how excited the investment market got today when they finally realized that Abu Dhabi is pumping these billions into Citibank?
Yes.
And you know, we're going to lose out. The nation's largest bank is probably going to be owned by foreign nationals.
Let me tell you, George, there's a section in my book, that I've just written, Day of Reckoning, that talks about something called sovereign wealth funds. Sovereign wealth funds. Let me tell you what they are. Since the United States has run $5 trillion in trade deficits since NAFTA, all these dollars have gone overseas, and they've piled up in the reserve accounts of countries like China, which has $1.4 trillion in reserves. Japan's got about $1 trillion. Russia's building them up because of oil. The oil states on the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, now have enormous funds of $500 billion and $1 trillion. Usually they get the dollars and they put them into T-bills and treasury bonds, and they get a solid 4%, 3.5%, 5% rate of interest over 30 years. And that's the basis of their economy, and it's their reserves, it's their rainy day fund. They've noticed since the dollar is sinking in value, all these T-bills and bonds are sinking in value, so they are now taking their money out and putting it into sovereign wealth funds, which are like investment funds.
Mm-hmm.
And these sovereign wealth funds are now starting slowly to move back into the United States and to begin to buy up strategic assets. Their primary purpose of most of them is to buy up, you know, corporate stocks and other things that are better investments, slightly riskier than T-bills and T-bonds. But the Chinese and others are now beginning to look at these enormous funds, which could grow by the middle of the next decade by one estimate. It's mentioned in my book. I think it was Larry Summers, or no, it was some bank, said, could grow to $17 trillion.
Oh, my gosh.
And you can, with these investment funds, if foreign folks can invest in General Motors and Microsoft and GE and all these stocks,
mm-hmm.
and these
banks,
high-tech companies, they can buy these sovereign wealth funds are gradually going to move along and invest in Citibank. They're already in Barclays. They're taking a look at some of these investment banks. And they're also taking a look. There's company, it's 3Com, I believe it is, the Chinese are looking at. And this is a company that builds the computer protection equipment for the Pentagon. And so with this money, I mean, they've got reach into our country, its most vital security corporations, and they're going to begin buying them up. And I'll tell you, the Americans, who are really hurting, like Citibank, they're going to start welcoming the funds. Welcome in. You got $12 billion, you're going to save us all, save our golden parachutes. Come aboard. We'll put you on the board. And a lot of your technology secrets are going overseas this way. I think this is going to be the hottest economic issue almost of the coming decade.
And it's all coming in at the same time, Pat. That's what's so incredible.
It is a perfect storm of crises.
It really is. I mean, I don't think a Hollywood scriptwriter, they're on strike now, but I don't think they could have written a better movie.
I think that's right. You know, as you look at it, when I was writing the book, you look at it and you see this David Walker, who seems to be a very conscientious man, head of the General Accounting Office, or the old General Accounting Office. I forget what they call it, the General something office now. But he's the Comptroller General also. He's been going around the country saying, look, you know, almost the end is near when it comes to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, that the baby boomers, George Bush's generation, George Bush and Clinton born in 1946.
I was born in 50. I won't see it, will I?
Well, here's the thing. You're coming to early retirement. They are in 2008, full retirement by 2012, and then 70 million baby boomers, and George, you're one of them, start moving away from the greatest contributors in all of history to Social Security and Medicare to the greatest consumers. And these unfunded mandates for Social Security and Medicare, they're in the tens of trillions of dollars. And we're moving there. And, of course, we added prescription drugs. And if Hillary gets in, we're going to be adding national health insurance. And you're going to have to almost take all the wealth from the private sector to maintain these things. And that's just one. And then you've got the problems in Afghanistan and Iraq. You've got the American army completely over. It's only 500,000 men and women, completely overextended. We're guaranteeing countries all over the world. You've got the open border, the failure to deal with that issue. You've got this the clash of cultures. I mean, the cultural war from the 1960s has divided us permanently. We just, you know, we're at war with one another over abortion and homosexuality and creationism and quotas and all of these issues. And so this is why I think we've got sort of a perfect storm of crises coming up and hitting the country at the same time. And you don't see any great awareness in either party of what is ahead.
Hey, Pat,
I'm not talking about way down the road. I'm talking about get ahead.
Stay on the line there, Pat. We'll be right back with you for another hour, then phone calls an hour after that for you. We'll be right back.